Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today we have news about the arrest of a serial arsonist accused of setting fires in our national forests. We also have hot stories from Santee's City Council hearing, including an increase in fire fees for some property owners, a heated debate over campaign finance changes, and a request by citizens to ban the sale of puppy mill dogs in Santee. In El Cajon, hear about a new fire museum ready to open and a four-star hotel approved by El Cajon's City Council. We also have word about a nationwide salmonella outbreak tied to backyard poultry, and it's linked to an odd trend of chicken snuggling. Two marijuana dispensaries have cleared another hurdle toward opening up shop in Ramona. And in San Diego, hear about the Maritime Museum's efforts to ban the docking of a famous little ship that helped bring about an international nuclear test ban treaty and inspire environmental activism, a story we learned about through a Ramona resident with Veterans for Peace, which owns the vessel. We'll tell you about a neighborhood watch training the sheriff is offering for East County residents and about a new recall of dog food. Hear about a human trafficking arrest made at the Border Patrol's checkpoint in Pine Valley. Plus, we have some good news for patients in need of medical devices. Hear how the Affordable Care Act's mandates are leading to longer and better warranties for implants in hearts, hips, and more. From Public News Service, learn about the latest national news at the top of the second half of our show today. Janice Mork will interview Mark Stevenson from the McAllister Institute on their efforts to help people turn their lives around and a big event they're having this weekend. Speaking of events, we'll also replay our interview with leaders from the San Diego Concert Band and Water Conservation Garden about their big benefit concert coming up next week. We'll have all these stories and more, so stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
CAL FIRE announces the arrest of a suspected serial arsonist. 44-year-old Benjamin Cohen from Poway, suspected of intentionally starting 11 fires between 2012 and 2015. CAL FIRE Director Ken Pimlott states, "To commit arson during these drought conditions is an exceptionally heinous crime, and we will seek prosecution to the fullest extent under the law." He asks residents to report any suspicious persons where a fire starts by notifying law enforcement. You can also call the arson hotline at 800-468-4408. Cohen is charged with 11 counts of arson to forest lands, one count of attempted arson to forest lands, and 12 counts of using an incendiary device. CAL FIRE has not disclosed which fires Cohen is believed to have started. He was arraigned at the East County Courthouse in El Cajon. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
At last week's Santee City Council meeting, 24 citizens came to support asking council to ban the sale of dogs from puppy mills. Sydney Sirkaral, West Coast Director for the Puppy Mill Project, told council members that her organization has gathered 3,000 signatures on a petition in support of the ban. The group has been protesting at Pups and Pets, a Santee store that she says purchases dogs from puppy mills where the animals are kept in what Sirkaral calls deplorable conditions. She said, "This store profits off egregious animal cruelty," and she added that pets at the store are kept in small cages for sometimes months at a time. She also accused the store of selling sick puppies that are winding up at the local animal shelter in El Cajon because owners cannot afford costly treatments or surgeries. Pups and Pets co-owner Sharon Franco spoke with our news partner, 10 News. She says her store used to have problems getting ill dogs from local breeders, but insists that since switching to large commercial breeders, puppies are healthy that come in. The facilities are USDA approved, she said, adding, "If there are bad breeders out there, they should shut them down. We are doing everything right. We follow every state and local regulation. We are inspected by Animal Control and the Humane Society on a regular basis." But Sirkaral insists that responsible breeders don't sell to pet stores. "We're not removing anyone's freedom," she says, of the proposed ban on pet store puppy sales, adding that people would still be free to buy dogs from breeders or get pets from local shelters. The Puppy Mill Project has led successful drives to get retail pet ordinances banning pet store sales of puppy mill dogs enacted in San Diego, Oceanside, and Encinitas locally, as well as other cities. Caitlin Finney also testified. She showed her purebred cocker spaniel, Maddie, who was rescued from a puppy mill in Mexico, where due to her rare coloration, she had been inbred and has numerous medical problems, Finney says. She told the council that she has spent over $5,000 on surgery because she loves her dog, but that many other pet owners who purchase a pet store puppy that turns out to be unhealthy are unable to afford such costly care. The council heard testimony during public comment, but no council member made a motion to put the retail pet ordinance issue on any future agenda. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Candidates running for Santee City Council or Mayor currently can only receive campaign contributions from individuals and no more than $650 per person. However, that may change due to a proposal that would strike the restriction to individual donors and open campaign contributions up to corporations, political action committees, and other organizations. Councilman John Minto had asked staff to research the legality of the city's ordinance, given recent court rulings, and to draft language to broaden the types of contributions allowed. At a city council meeting last week, City Attorney Sean Haggerty told council members that the current law is similar to ones many other California jurisdictions have. Despite recent court rulings on some campaign finance issues, he made clear local limits to individuals have not been called into question and there is no requirement to change that. Despite that, some council members seemed eager to allow corporate and political action committees to contribute money into local races to help pay for rising campaign costs. Council staff indicated that the city could leave the provision as is or make one of two changes. One, eliminate the provision by striking it from the books. This would open up campaign donations to any and all persons or organizations that wish to contribute. Two, add new wording to the law that would define new contributors and distinctions. Both proposals also would raise the donation limit from $650 to $700 and eliminate the restriction that campaign funds be kept in a Santee bank since there's no longer a locally owned bank in Santee. Minto seemed to favor option number one, eliminating the restriction to individual donors altogether and raising the limit to $700. He pointed out that campaigning for office has become very expensive. Mayor Randy Vopel noted that a council campaign costs $18,000 to $20,000. A contest seat or a mayoral race can run $30,000 to $45,000, so he favors raising limits and allowing contributions beyond individual. Vopel had a proposal of his own, raise the limit to $1,000 and allow entities including corporations, political action committees, and individuals to donate to candidates in Santee. He said incumbents have a huge advantage and this would limit the playing field. But Councilmember Jack Dale said eliminating the restrictions to individuals was bad policy. He said he's never spent that much on a campaign and has been elected several times. Opening up campaign contributions to corporations is going down a slippery slope, declared Dale, who added, if you can't win with $650, that is per person from individuals, perhaps you shouldn't be running. Councilmember Rob McNellis called the proposal scary. He said developers with business before the council could buy considerable influence. I can't support that, he added. The city attorney acknowledged that the downside of eliminating restrictions could be multiple contributions that seem to be directed by one person, such as a corporation donating along with its directors and their wives. Even Minto, who initially asked staff to draft language to raise limits and allow donations from PACs, political action committees, and corporations, admitted that the idea of big money controlled by one person makes it too scary for me, but said he'd support a higher $1,000 limit for individuals. He said he brought the motion forward because some donors don't have checking accounts anymore and want to donate with a business checking account. Councilmember McNellis motioned that staff research and report on the repercussions of changing the law, so the matter was tabled for now to be brought up at a later date. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
If you own commercial or industrial property in Santee, your taxes may soon be going up. The Santee City Council has voted to raise the fire benefit fee for all commercial and industrial properties to a maximum of $492 per building per year. Parcels with multiple buildings will now owe the fee for every building. The highest increase faced by any property owner would be $1,800, staff told council. Councilman Jack Dale observed this is really a per-building fee, whether you're 500 square feet or your Costco. Councilman Ron Hall noted that property owners would be real unhappy to get a hefty bill from the city. I'm not going for this, he declared. The measure passed 3-1, with Mayor Randy Vopel casting the only no vote. Hall, who owns property that could be affected, abstained. Council members John Minto, Rob McNellis, and Dale voted for the fee increase. The fire benefit fee, which funds firefighting in Santee, has been in place since 1993. All residential property owners pay the same amount, $41 per dwelling unit per year, and they've done so since the fee's inception. But a recent parcel audit and analysis of commercial and industrial properties found inconsistencies, with some charged the maximum amount of $492 and others much less. This measure aims to make the assessment equal for all commercial industrial buildings, although, as Dale noted, the measure makes no distinction on the size of the structure assessed. Increased assessments that are under $287 will be implemented in full this fiscal year, while assessments between $287 and $491 will be phased in over 2 years, and those hikes of $492 or more will be phased in over 3 years. The fire benefit fee is expected to bring in over $990,000 in fiscal year 2015-16, and that's a $65,000 increase from the year before. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
It's been years in the planning, and now retired El Cajon Fire Chief Ed Gerald, partnering with Parkway Plaza, is bringing a fire museum to the city of El Cajon. It's been a long time dream for the former fire chief to provide the city with a history of firefighting in El Cajon, also inspiring youth to pursue a fire career and providing safety education to those who visit the museum. The city first wanted to put the museum on Reyes Street in downtown El Cajon, but after the state took away redevelopment money, that plan got burned. Fortunately, Chief Gerald, who has acquired a large collection of firefighter-related items, has found a new venue at the Parkway Plaza Mall. The museum is located on the far west end of the mall, between Sears and Dick's Sporting Goods. Children will have their own kids' corner to color and read. In addition, an area that offers career and safety information. The museum will officially open with a ribbon-cutting ceremony Saturday, July 18th at 10:30 a.m. For more information or to be a contributing sponsor for the nonprofit effort, you can stop by the museum after July 18th or call 619-441-1737. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is DeVario Bell.
East County will soon have its first four-star hotel. The El Cajon Council has approved final plans for a Marriott Courtyard Hotel to be built at Magnolia and Rhea Avenues. The site is just down the block from the East County Performing Arts Center, slated for renovation and reopening in the near future, all part of downtown revitalization efforts in El Cajon. Several years ago, the council had considered tearing down the Performing Arts Center and selling the land off to a hotel developer, but backed off after an outcry from the citizens. Councilman Gary Kendrick calls the approval of the Marriott a landmark event, adding that the new hotel will provide jobs, investment in the city, and benefits for El Cajon citizens, UT San Diego reports. El Cajon currently has several motels, but this will be the city's first hotel. The 120-room hotel is slated for completion next year, following teardown of buildings currently on the site. Marriott purchased the land for just under $1.2 million. Marriott will keep transient occupancy fees generated during the first 5 years to help recoup its costs, after which those fees will be split 50-50 in years 6 through 10. After the 10th year, El Cajon will keep 100% of the fees. The hotel, slated to rise 5 stories high, will also include restaurants, 2 meeting rooms, and commercial space for lease, as well as 100 parking spaces. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Leon Thompson.
How you gonna keep 'em down on the farm after they
This is Miriam Raftery with an important health and agricultural alert. Across the nation, people have flocked to raising backyard chickens and other poultry for eggs. Several cities in East County have recently legalized backyard chicken ownership. But now the U.S. Centers for Disease Control has issued a warning not to cozy up to your backyard birds. That's because four separate salmonella outbreaks linked to backyard flocks have sickened 181 people in 40 states, including several cases right here in California. In one outbreak, the CDC conducted interviews and they found that 86% of the ill people had contact with chicks, chickens, ducks, or ducklings before falling ill. Moreover, the CDC reports many ill people in these outbreaks reported bringing the live poultry into their homes, and others reported kissing or cuddling with the live poultry. These behaviors increase a person's risk of salmonella infection, the CDC warns. So who knew that chicken snuggling was so popular? Some websites for backyard poultry enthusiasts have encouraged this, and it turns out there's even a national Hug a Chicken Day each November 5th, according to BackyardChickens.com. But the CDC warns that that is not a good idea. In its recently issued advice to backyard flock owners, the CDC warns that contact with live poultry and their environment can make people sick with salmonella infections. Live poultry can be carrying salmonella bacteria, but appear healthy and clean and show no signs of illness. The CDC offers these tips to protect yourself and others while you're enjoying your backyard poultry. Wash your hands thoroughly with soap and water after touching live poultry or anything where they live and roam, or you can use a hand sanitizer if soap and water isn't available. Always supervise hand washing for young children. Don't let live poultry inside the house, in bathrooms, or especially in areas where food or drink is prepared, served, or stored, such as kitchens or outdoor patios. Children younger than 5 years old and adults older than 65, as well as people with weakened immune systems, should not handle or touch chicks, ducklings, or other live poultry. People in these groups are more likely to have a severe illness from salmonella infection. Do not snuggle or kiss those birds, touch your mouth, or eat or drink around live poultry. Stay outdoors when cleaning any equipment or material used to raise or care for live poultry, such as cages or feed or water containers. These recommendations are important and apply to all live poultry, regardless of the age of the birds or where you purchased them, the CDC advises. The infected birds actually came from at least 17 different hatcheries. The CDC also has guidelines for mail-order hatcheries and feed stores that sell or display live produce, including providing information and displaying posters to alert buyers about salmonella risks, displaying poultry out of reach of customers, especially children, and cleaning areas thoroughly where birds are displayed between shipments. Salmonella can result in fever, cramping, and severe intestinal tract problems. While most people recover within a week without treatment, salmonella can cause infection in other parts of the body or, in rare cases, even death. So when in doubt, leave those chickens outside of your house, that is, and follow the CDC's guidelines to keep you and your family safe, while still enjoying all of those fresh eggs, which, by the way, should always be cooked thoroughly to avoid any risk of salmonella.
The county has approved building permits for two medical marijuana collectives in Ramona, the Ramona Sentinel reports. But before facilities can open their doors to dispense or grow medical marijuana, they must first obtain approvals from the Sheriff's Department. The collective seek to open at 1210 Olive Street and at 619 Pine Street. To obtain approval from the Sheriff, each facility must have an alarm system monitored by the Sheriff's Department, closed circuit video monitoring, and shatter-resistant glass in windows and doors, among other measures. The county currently has only one medical marijuana facility licensed by the sheriff located near Gillespie Field. Zoning requirements mandate that such facilities be on industrial zone land at least 1,000 feet from schools, parks, and other places where children are apt to be. The county has identified additional potential sites, most of them in Lakeside and Ramona. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jawan Armstrong.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
Dave Patterson, a Ramona resident and a member of Veterans for Peace, has brought us a fascinating story. The San Diego Maritime Museum has refused to allow Veterans for Peace to dock its ship, the Golden Rule, at the Museum of Maritime History. Despite the vessel's success in helping bring about a ban on nuclear testing and inspiring generations of activism among both peace and environmental groups through the daring actions of the Golden Rule's crew on the high seas.
This tiny ketch was made famous for its 1958 voyage to the Marshall Islands, where its crew tried to stop atmospheric nuclear weapons tests. The crew was arrested in Hawaii before the ship reached its destination, sparking protests among American citizens who demanded that the Golden Rule be allowed to set sail. The ship's actions drew global attention to fallout from the nuclear testing and radiation turning up even in mother's milk. That worldwide attention helped lead to the 1963 Limited Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. The Golden Rule's success also inspired later groups, including Greenpeace, which gained fame for putting its ships in front of whalers to protect whales, helping lead to an international ban on whaling. Veterans for Peace later purchased and restored the Golden Rule vessel as a symbol of peace, and the group hoped to dock it here for its August convention. The reason for refusing the Golden Rule docking privileges is political. According to an article in the Lost Coast Outpost, the Maritime Museum's media spokesman, Vincent Hernandez, said the Golden Rule was refused docking privilege because of its history as promoting civil disobedience, which, quote, does not align with the mission of the Maritime Museum. The museum has claimed that the Golden Rule falls into current events category, not history, despite the fact that the museum has plenty of ships from wars fought in recent decades, such as a Vietnam War swift boat and even a Soviet-made submarine. It also has others that are not historic at all, such as a replica of a warship used in the movie Master and Command, starring Russell Crowe. The museum's curator told East County Magazine that the museum feared losing its nonprofit 501c3 status if it allowed a ship with a political message to dock. And yet, the museum clearly contains pro-war messaging, and arguably, by allowing only one side of the story, the museum itself is being political. Across the nation, other museums, including the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C., have included anti-war messaging as well as military displays. Critics of the museum policy have suggested that the real agenda may be San Diego's strong pro-military attitude, or perhaps a lack of willingness to risk offending museum donors. But the facility is not a museum of military history, but rather maritime history. A small ship that inspired treaties to ban nuclear testing and whaling, becoming a symbol for peace worldwide, seems clearly in line with the museum's own mission of educating the public about maritime history, not merely pro-war maritime history with which its backers agree. Reporting for KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Ed Barena reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ. Residents across East County are invited to a Neighborhood Watch training program with staff from the Lakeside Sheriff's Substation. The training will be held at the Lakeside Community Center on Friday, July 17th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Neighborhood Watch captains, those who don't yet belong to a Neighborhood Watch group, and people who are interested in establishing a Neighborhood Watch program in their neighborhood are all welcome to participate. The program will have tips for residents who are concerned about crime, public safety, and a desire to heighten their awareness of criminal activity such as burglaries, and also to learn how to defend against it in their own neighborhood. East County residents are encouraged to attend and bring their neighbors. You can also visit sdsheriff.net to find your nearest sheriff station or substation for more information on Neighborhood Watch programs in your neighborhood.
This is Leon Thompson with news about some recent pet product recalls. A recall has been announced of Chewy's chicken freeze-dried dinner patties for dogs due to Listeria, a bacteria that causes illness that was found in one of their products. The latest recall covers 15-ounce bags. Other recent pet food recalls include Boulder Dog Food Company Foods, Nylabone Puppy Starter Kits, and Nutrish Wet Cat Food. A full list of recalls is posted on PetPlace.com. If you suspect your pet has been affected by this recall, you can report it to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration at FDA.gov.
U.S. Border Patrol agents at a checkpoint on Interstate 8 near Pine Valley found three undocumented Mexican immigrants in a vehicle trunk last Monday. Two men in a Volkswagen Jetta approached the checkpoint, where a Border Patrol canine team alerted agents who found two women and a man in the trunk. According to the Border Patrol, all three of the immigrants were sweating profusely from the high temperature and lack of ventilation. The driver and his passenger, both American citizens, were arrested and will face federal charges for human smuggling. Their vehicle was seized by the Border Patrol. Reporting for the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, this is Ed Barena.
Financial penalties imposed by Medicare on hospitals that have to readmit too many patients is having a positive impact. Scrutiny of readmissions is mandated under the Affordable Care Act. Hospitals seeking to protect their bottom lines have been pushing for better guarantees from medical device manufacturers, and they're beginning to see results. Until now, patients with a failed medical device often had to resort to lawsuits to get compensation, and warranties generally only covered the device itself, not the high cost of new surgery to remove a failed device and install a new one, or treat infections from items implanted into the body. In other cases, insurance companies got stuck with the tab. But now some manufacturers have agreed to strengthen guarantees and compensate hospitals if a device fails. Reuters reports that Medtronic PLC, Johnson & Johnson, and St. Jude Medical are among the first to improve their guarantees on heart devices, and some include sharing the costs of follow-up treatment with hospitals. Some orthopedic implant makers are also considering offering similar agreements on knee and hip replacement parts. But some say that doesn't go far enough. Hospitals, however, are seeking even more, wanting device makers to pay the full cost of new surgery to replace faulty products. The Consumers Union Safe Patient Project, however, wants to see warranties offered to patients, not hospitals. This is Leon Thompson with a health report on East County Magazine.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, July 13th, 2015. I'm Mary Sherman. We're covering stories from around the nation, including a voting rights trial in North Carolina could have national implications, calls to fix a gun law loophole in the wake of a shooting massacre, and dismay in the U.S. over a drug lord's Mexican prison escape. Leading our news, the national spotlight is on North Carolina today as a historic voting rights trial gets underway, challenging what its opponents describe as a monster voting suppression law. The North Carolina NAACP is arguing in the case that HB 589 violates the Voting Rights Act by disproportionately targeting people of color. Executive Director Reverend William Barber says it shortens early voting, eliminates same-day registration, and expands the ability to challenge voters.
This is our Selma. We are challenging this law because it's the worst attempt to suppress the vote by the extremists in the legislature and our governor to take away from the citizens of North Carolina voting opportunities that they've already used in two election cycles.
The changes were adopted by the state legislature in 2013, immediately after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the heart of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, when it ended a requirement that nine states with histories of discrimination, including North Carolina, get federal approval before altering their election laws. But the case, as well as one involving a Texas law requiring voters to show a photo ID, could have far wider repercussions, legal experts say, helping to define the scope of voting rights protections across the country in the coming presidential election and beyond. It's an admitted breakdown in the federal background check system that may have cost nine lives, and today Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy will meet with the FBI and the Department of Justice to discuss that failure. We get the details from Mike Clifford.
Dylan Roof, the 21-year-old suspect in the South Carolina church shooting, was able to purchase a handgun despite an arrest on a drug charge and an admission of drug use. Murphy says the system failed when a decision didn't come during the three-day waiting period.
This was a pending case, and the retailer sold Dylan Root the gun simply because they ran out of time. They couldn't get the case resolved in 3 days. That's something we should be able to fix.
Under current law, the FBI has 3 days to determine whether there is enough evidence to deny a purchase. The New York Times reports that the Justice Department's Inspector General was already investigating other cases where convicted felons and other prohibited buyers made purchases after the waiting period. FBI Director James Comey said, "We are all sick this happened."
Reactions in the U.S. to the escape from Mexican prison of a reputed drug lord range from disbelief to outrage, with some observers saying it dramatically illustrates the need for captured cartel kingpins to be promptly extradited to the U.S. A former administrator of the Drug Enforcement Agency said he was dismayed by Joaquin El Chapo Guzman's weekend escape, apparently through a mile-long tunnel from the prison 55 miles west of Mexico City. It was 2 weeks ago today that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in an Oklahoma case that a controversial drug could be used in executions. Ironically, abolitionists in Kentucky are seeing a silver lining in the 5-4 decision by focusing on what dissenting justices had to say.
Justice Stephen Breyer wrote, "Rather than try to patch up the death penalty's legal wounds one at a time, I would ask for full briefing on a more basic question, whether the death penalty violates the Constitution." Mike Von Allman volunteers with the Kentucky Coalition to abolish the death penalty.
For them to add their weight to it certainly gives weight to the entire question. Yes, the rest of the court should heed that message and begin to look at it.
Von Allman brings a unique perspective to the debate. Convicted of sexual assault and robbery in 1982, he spent 11 years behind bars and another 16 years on parole before being exonerated in 2010. Kentucky is among 31 states where the death penalty remains legal, legislators often citing it as a deterrent to crime. I'm Greg Stottlemyre reporting.
In environmental news, church leaders are bringing arguments for cutting ties with fossil fuels closer to home.
To combat climate change, U.S. Episcopal church leaders recently voted to divest $380 million in businesses involved with fossil fuels. Betsy Blake Bennett, an archdeacon from Nebraska, says the next task is to begin conversations in local parishes, which control some $4 billion Episcopal dollars altogether, to consider reinvesting in clean energy.
Look at our portfolios, see if where our money is matches the gospel values that we preach. Life is sacred and creation is sacred, and it's our duty to not let everything die without putting up a fight.
Bennett says plans for talks are already underway in her diocese, but adds others may join in as late as winter. The Christian denomination did not elect to divest its largest holdings, $9 billion in pension funds. I'm Eric Galatis.
I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
This is Janice Russell, host of People Power, profiling people and organizations making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is Janice Russell with East County Magazine and People Power. I'm here with Mark Stevenson, who is from El Cajon and is a graduate of the McAllister Institute, one of San Diego's largest and most experienced drug and alcohol treatment and education centers. He has had a 20-year history of working with people and systems in the areas of substance abuse, mental health, criminal justice, family, and homeless social service. Today, we will interview him about his background and the work he has done, among other topics. Mark, can you tell listeners more about your background?
Well, my family and I moved here in the 60s, and I basically have been an El Cajon resident ever since then. I think to go into my background, I would have to kind of talk a little bit about the struggles that I ended up having. As I was growing up, I was one of those candidates to become addicted. I suffered a lot of turmoil in my life due to the use of drugs and alcohol. I am also one of those people that ended up costing the system money through incarceration, hospitalization, and things like that. I've managed to make it out of all of those struggles. I went back to school at a later age, and I got a master's degree in social work at San Diego State University right here in our own community. After I got that master's degree and during while I was going to school, I began working in human services, including substance abuse treatment myself. And I've expanded my career ever since then. And now I'm a productive member of the El Cajon Society out here, a homeowner, a taxpayer, somebody who has a reasonably good amount of success and has chosen a career where I can turn around and help people in the same way that I've been helped.
How and when did you come to the McAllister Institute? Was it challenging to receive treatment there at first?
Well, I think I probably underwent the same challenges anybody suffering from addiction goes through, and that is the challenge of being willing to go to treatment or really understanding the actual problem. Sometimes an addicted person can be in the middle of a whirlwind in their life and not really realize or attach what the real issues are. So when I went to McAllister Institute, I basically was likely in a lot of denial about exactly what needed to be changed. All I really knew at that time is I wanted certain bad things to stop happening in my life that have been happening over and over again. I think the blessing came through staying there long enough to let the people there help me understand all of that and break things down into manageable pieces and help me, you know, through information and support, begin to build my own understanding of what my problems were and what my solutions were.
What inspired you to turn your life around?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that because in the beginning when I first went to McAllister Institute, I was still wanted by the police on another charge that I ultimately was going to have to face. And I think my true reason for going in the beginning was try to make up some kind of a story to try to get out of it. But I think my inspiration, my true inspiration came later when I had a deeper understanding of what my problems were and what types of things that I needed to do. I was one of those people that needed to recognize I was addicted and needed to recognize that my solution was going to be recovery. And while I was at McAllister Institute, I think the more I learned about recovery and the more that McAllister allowed me to be exposed to the recovery process and the recovery support that existed in the community, including the support that they gave through treatment, I began to become inspired not only to recover, but to recover the rest of my life as well. And that inspiration is what ultimately grew into the inspiration that I have now in working with other people.
You also worked at Father Joe's Villages. Can you describe that experience?
I can start to describe that experience by first starting to talk a little bit about my work with McAllister. I worked with McAllister Institute about 11 years. And some of the things that I learned at McAllister Institute basically paved my way for the work that I now do with the homeless through Father Joe's Villages. I remember speaking with Jean early on in my career, and Jean did a lot of teaching to those of us that were working for her to help us understand the people that were, the broken people that we were working with and what they were capable of and the strengths that they did possess deep down inside. And she said to me one time, Mark, it's not the clients that do everything right that are going to teach you the most in this field. It's the ones that don't get anything right that are going to teach you most. You're working with the least loved people in society. And if you can learn to love them for who and what they are and where they're at, it's only then that you're probably going to be able to pass on any type of a gift or solution to them that will matter to them. And now, working at Father Joe's Villages for the past 10 years, working with the homeless, I have a real good idea of the people that she was talking about because I, once again, am working with the least loved people in society. And I learned, through my work at McAllister Institute and through the teachings that Jean gave me, that I'm working with the least loved people in the world and that outside of all the clinical interventions that we give and the solutions that we give and the resources that we provide, that I try to mix a little love and compassion for their position in life and for what they're capable of.
And what inspired you to work with the people and systems in the areas of substance abuse, mental health, criminal justice, family, and homeless social service?
Again, while I was working at McAllister Institute, Jean had always inspired the people that she hired who had a good grasp on recovery and could pass that gift on to others to also pursue other education so that they could continue in their professional development. McAllister Institute was a great training ground for me. Jean and McAllister Institute, while I was working there, supported me in pursuing school. I think the motivation, the validation, and the understanding of what it took to, you know, be working and going to school while I was at McAllister Institute inspired me to continue on. And I started out with a group of people that were doing the same thing, and I think I was the only one that stuck with it in that particular group. But again, the inspiration to work with people, to work with systems, to work with substance abuse, to work with mental health was inspired at McAllister Institute. They implemented the welcoming policy for mental health because they recognized the trend of people with mental health problems coming in that always also had substance abuse problems. They helped me recognize that unless I was able to connect them to certain resources and understand their relationship with the systems they'd be involved in, that they wouldn't get a full recovery in dealing with life on life's terms. So all of this was the basis for my inspiration to work in this field. And working at Father Joe's Villages, I think I've really found a home because I love working with the homeless. I love watching them go through the process that they need to go through to get to the point where they too can become productive members of society.
Okay, that's very nice. The McAllister 4th Annual Walk for Sobriety is coming up on Saturday, July 18th. Can you give us more details about the event and where people can find more information?
Definitely. I know that in this tough economy, it's difficult for some of the programs that really help people in the same way that I've been helped to become a productive member of society to get all of the funding that they need to do the magic that they do in these programs. And so it's not uncommon for any program, including McAllister Institute, to be out there trying to raise money to supplement the money that they get so that they can run the over 28 programs that they currently have now that are changing lives. I know McAllister right now is trying to raise at least 500 walkers and hopes to raise about $75,000 to support things like the women and children that are being served in Kiva to change their life, to turn people on parole into productive members of society, you know, much like myself. The women and children's lives that they touch, all of this supplemental money goes along to helping support the programs in ways that their current funding doesn't. And those costs seem to be increasing over time. So McAllister has been doing this walk, and this is about 4 years now. And one of the things and one of the messages that they hope to get out there is not only, yes, we need help in continuing to, you know, provide this type of donations and support, is that the cost of doing nothing is much greater than the cost of providing these services. This annual walk will provide the kind of donations that will be much less costly if these type of treatment services were not in the community. I'm working with a Project 25 over at Father Joe's Villages, and I work with some of the severest alcoholics in the city of San Diego that are identified by both the city and the county and other resources in the community. And 36 of these people cost over $4.2 million in a single year in emergency services use. And the cost of doing nothing for these folks was much higher than the money we were able to save through helping these people get situated, get the support that they needed, help them change their lives, and help them get into housing. We reduced that cost and saved the community over $2.5 million. The subsequent charges that could happen in the community are that there's less productivity if these folks aren't being productive members of society. Higher health care costs because of the repetitive use of the health care system because nobody's accessing preventive care, a reduction in crime in the community, and a reduced amount of incarceration costs. You know, one person going to prison for 1 year is approximately $63,000. So you see the $75,000 that we hope to raise from McAllister Institute could drop that $63,000 charge for multiple people. McAllister served over 7,100 people last year. Alone and have served tens of thousands of people in the 38-year history that they've been in process. If we had a way to calculate all the money saved by turning lives around, I think it would be not that big of a question to say, yeah, this is a worthy cause and that we all definitely want to contribute it in some way, either by donation or showing up at the walk to show that recovery works or that you support recovery in this community.
Okay, very good. Are there any more events coming up that you would like to tell the listeners about?
In support of the Walk for Sobriety, which can be accessed at www.walkforsobriety.com on the web for more information, there are a number of clean and sober motorcycle groups that are in the community that have turned their lives around, that are productive members of society and still ride motorcycles. And on that day, at between 9 and 10 in the morning, they're going to meet at San Diego Harley-Davidson, and they're going to ride down to the Walk for Sobriety event to support that event and show from the clean and sober motorcycle club community, subpopulation, so to speak, that recovery works for them and that they also support it.
Okay, good. Are there any last thoughts that you wish to share?
I think if I was going to share anything to anyone, is that we all need to have compassion for each other, and we have to apply that compassion in so many different ways. Every human being on the planet needs some kind of help from somebody sometime. And this includes our people who are addicted. This includes our people who are homeless. And whatever types of charity that we can give to each other is important, and it should spread across the classes, it should spread across the races, and it should spread across the communities, you know, so that we're all hand in hand and helping each other the way McAllister Institute has helped me.
This is Janice Russell from East County Magazine and People Power, and I just interviewed Mark Stevenson, who is from El Cajon and a graduate of the McAllister Institute. You can look for an article about Mark on www.eastcountymagazine.org, and for more information about McAllister Institute, you can go to walkforsobriety.com. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
Ladies and gentlemen, the San Diego Concert Band, under the direction of Roy S. Anthony Jr.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording in our studio in the East County Wellness Center here in El Cajon. Today, my very special guests are Chuck Brown, who is the president of the San Diego Concert Band, and John Bolthouse, the executive director of the Water Conservation Garden. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Miriam.
Thanks for having us.
Now, John, I understand that you have an announcement about a very special event that's coming up at the Garden in July. Tell us about it.
Yeah, we're very pleased for our third straight year to host the San Diego Concert Band on Sunday, July 26th. This is a great community event. It's also a fundraiser, a joint fundraiser between the Water Conservation Garden out in El Cajon and the San Diego Concert Band. And it's a great way to enjoy the summertime in a great botanical garden, an outdoor setting with friends and family, and some really wonderful music by a great community band.
That sounds marvelous and benefiting two very worthy causes here in East County in San Diego. The concert begins at 6 p.m. and the gates open at 4:30 for those that want to come early and stroll through the gardens. Now, Chuck, can you give us a little preview of what we can expect to hear at the concert?
Well, the band's summer series typically are lighter, more popular music that people are more familiar with. We're playing some exciting arrangements by three different Japanese composers, one of which is Moonlight Serenade, the famous Glenn Miller standard.
Oh, yes.
We're also doing another piece that is straight out of New Orleans. It's a street composition of When the Saints Go Marching In, which includes the typical go to the mortuary funeral beginning and then the much more uplifting saints type thing when they're going back from the funeral proceedings. And we're doing some popular American marches like Chimes of Liberty. We're doing another exciting piece from the U.S. Air Force Band. It's the theme song for the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. called Flight. Very interesting piece. So there'll be a lot of stuff that people are familiar with, and we'll introduce some new stuff that people hopefully will like.
Fascinating. And I understand one of those new pieces is by a local composer.
Yes. Each year, our band director, Roy Anthony, chooses a fanfare opening that we can use, kind of like the call to post at Del Mar for bands. And this year he commissioned Adam Pezdik, who's a trombonist with us, also recently retired Marine Corps musician, who was in Roy Anthony's high school band at Mount Miguel High School. Adam's piece, the commissioned fanfare, is titled Matador Mountain. And as you might expect, being a Mount Miguel High School Matador alumni, there's a little bit of Spanish influence and fanfare trumpetry and lots of stuff like that for the opener. We've been playing it all summer, and people really seem to enjoy it.
Well, that sounds very exciting. We're going to listeners give you a little sneak preview of that piece, the fanfare Matador Mountain, right now. Thank you for sharing. That was marvelous. I'm really looking forward to coming and hearing the whole thing at the concert coming up at the Garden on July 26th at 6 p.m.
We're looking forward to you and your radio listeners being there.
Now, I want to talk a little bit more about the band itself, which has quite an impressive history. Tell us a little bit about how it all got started and some of the milestones you've had through the years, Chuck.
The band was founded in fall of 1989, and it was originally based in the La Mesa area at Grossmont High School, and we've rehearsed variously at Grossmont, Helix, and now at La Mesa Middle School. The band's membership, however, is from all over the county. We have people traveling from Rancho Bernardo, Point Loma, South Bay, and of course a lot of East County musicians as well from Spring Valley, El Cajon, La Mesa, and Rancho San Diego. The band has played a consistent series of concerts every year. We have two formal concerts at Joan Kroc Theater in East San Diego at the Salvation Army Corps facility. And we do six or eight summer concerts, typically free in the park around town.
And, yes, you just had one at La Mesa. The concert's at six out there. And our reviewer, Jaime Meerman with East County Magazine, wrote of the band, "Their love of music shows in the quality of their interpretations, their discipline, and the warmth of the sound they project."
And we thank Jaime for those wonderful words. We've been playing in that particular venue, a nice amphitheater, as is the Water Conservation Garden, ever since 1990, when the trees in the park were no taller than our tallest musician, who happened to be 6 feet seven. And it's always a pleasure. We opened the summer series there this year again, and we're always happy to play in that venue.
Very nice. I understand that you are in the running for a National SUSE Award. You certainly do a marvelous job with the SUSE marches when you play them. Tell us the progress that you're making toward the award.
The John Philip Sousa Foundation has a special awards program for community bands called the Sudler Silver Scroll. And in order to apply for the distinction and be awarded the Silver Scroll, it takes 3 years to compile programs, musical excerpts, a demonstration CD, publicity, reviews like Mr. Meerman's, and everything like that. So we're in the second of 3 years of putting all this together. And it's not so much a competition as it is a recognition. Foundation may or may not award any Silver Scroll awards any particular year, and sometimes they may award more than one.
Listeners, if you just tuned in, we are speaking with Chuck Brown, the president of the San Diego Concert Band, and John Bolthouse, the executive director at the Water Conservation Garden, about the upcoming An Evening of Music in the Garden event on July 26th at 6 p.m. Now, John, for those who may not be familiar with the Water Conservation Garden, can you tell us a little bit about it, its mission, and how it got started?
Well, Miriam, I guess the quickest way to put it is, remember the last drought we were in?
if you're
from San Diego, back in the late 80s.
Filling those buckets up from the shower.
You did it back then. Okay. So you were a leader back then too. Well, as a consequence of that drought back in the late 80s, early 90s, a couple of the water agencies, got together. Otay and Helix got together with Cuyamaca College and said, you know what? Let's put together a demonstration garden for our community to show folks how they can do it the right way. In their landscaping, to plant California native water-wise drought-tolerant plants, and how you can save water and still have a beautiful landscape. So that was kind of the founding of the garden. We opened to the public in 1999, so we've been open for about 16 years now.
Yeah.
Over that time, we've garnered additional support in the community. We have a very robust volunteer corps, almost 100 volunteers at the garden. We've grown our programs. We've enhanced and expanded our demonstration exhibits at the garden. So we are really making a name for ourselves, not just in East County, but also in the entire region.
Yeah, it's certainly a beautiful place with a lot that you can learn there. How many acres do you have?
We are just under 6 acres. So we do a lot with a very modest space right adjacent to Cuyamaca College.
Yeah, and it's more than water conservation now, although that's certainly extremely important, probably even more so than when you first opened your doors. You can also, listeners, learn about fire-wise landscaping and a lot of other things, vegetable gardening and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, it's important. A lot of people don't realize that the two, water conservation and fire-wise landscaping, aren't necessarily the same. We had a house once where there were some slope stability issues, and we went out and planted for that. And we said, we want to make sure we get something that's really drought tolerant. And after we put it in, someone said, well, you know, those are flammable, don't you? They're one of the worst things from a fire stamp. I went, oh no. So it's really good to cross check both of them when you're
planting up your yard.
That's an excellent point. Actually, yeah. It's all about the types of plants you use, and with regards to erosion control and with regards to fire-wise gardening, it's all about where you put them. And we actually have a couple of demonstration gardens for both of those, erosion and fire-wise. The other key in proper gardening, particularly here in Southern California in our semi-arid conditions, is proper irrigation. You can put the best water-conserving plants in your landscape, spend lots of money, but if you don't use the right irrigation, you're just wasting your time. So you want to make sure water gets right to the root of your plants and only to the root of your plants. There's no need to spray water all over the place and waste our water by having it evaporate. Mm-hmm. So, and we have all those types of demonstrations at the garden, both in our programs and in our demonstration gardens.
And I understand for people who love butterflies and native plants, you've got some new exhibits to share. Tell us about those.
Yeah, well, last spring we opened our butterfly pavilion. And just a couple of weeks ago, we opened our new native habitat garden. And this is a kind of a direction that more and more landscape architects are going, which is ecology landscaping.
Yeah.
It's putting plants in your home or HOA or commercial properties that can supplement or complement the local habitat. I mean, you as a homeowner can have a positive impact on the local ecology. And so we have these two popular new exhibits that help folks learn how to do that. And by the way, it's also really neat to bring kids and families to see all the butterflies as well.
They love it. Children and butterflies, you know, just made for each other. I think we had a butterfly garden ourselves at our old house, and my kids just loved watching those butterflies hatch out of a chrysalis and learning a lot about nature.
The science behind it is fascinating for all ages, actually, yes.
Back to you, Chuck. Can you tell us what else the San Diego Concert Band has coming up this season?
Yes, besides our concert on the 26th at the Garden, we are also playing again at Balboa Park at the Organ Pavilion in the Balboa Park Twilight in the Park series that runs every summer for about 3 months. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday night, there's free entertainment at the park. The Organ Pavilion's a great venue, the good sunshine, early evening, great place to go, another place you can take a picnic if you'd like. We'll be playing there on August 11th, mm-hmm. and the concerts this season begin at 6:30 p.m. and run for about an hour. After that, we're going to be playing a very late concert in September. It will actually be the closer for the Sundays at 6 series at Griffin Park in La Mesa. We're combining with the Delta Music Makers from Ladner, British Columbia. They host a band festival every year, and we've been corresponding with them. They'd like to get our band to their festival in Vancouver, and they're making a Southern California tour, and they wanted to swing by San Diego and play a joint concert with us. So it'll be two bands for the price of one, free.
Very good. It sounds like you've got a very versatile repertoire and some amazing programs coming up this summer. Where can people go to get ticket information about the concerts coming up this summer, including the one we've been speaking about, the concert on the 26th of July at the Water Conservation Garden?
All of our concerts are free in the venues that we play, except for the Water Conservation Garden. And being a joint fundraiser, we obviously have to have donations to raise funds.
Mm-hmm.
Tickets are available live at the garden in their gift shop and from band members. But more simply, you can go to the San Diego Concert Band website, www.sandiegoconcertband.com, and there's a link there to our ticket sales, and you'll be able to get an electronic ticket from the web right there.
And John, if people want to learn more about the Water Conservation Garden, not just the concert, but all of the wonderful programs that you have there, maybe come visit, where can they go to find that?
Well, that's very easy. It is at thegarden.org. And we also actually have a very active, dynamic Facebook presence as well. So you can actually track us on Facebook and on Twitter. But as Chuck said, we also welcome folks to come out to the garden. Like I said, we're right adjacent to Queen Maka College. You can get an idea of all the various programs that we offer as well, many of which are free to our members.
Very good. I want to thank both of you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road,
We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.